File 59.
These and such things, however, are only mere bagatelles. What was much worse was the feeling, which spread throughout large sections of the nation, that the affairs of the individual were being taken care of from above, and that he did not need to bother himself with them. As long as the government was really good, or at least moved by goodwill, no serious objections could be raised. But the country was destined to disaster when the old government, which had at least striven for the best, became replaced by a new regime which was not of the same quality. Then the docile obedience and infantile credulity which formerly offered no resistance was bound to be one of the most fatal evils that can be imagined. But against these and other defects, there were certain qualities which undoubtedly had a positive effect. First of all, the monarchical form of government guarantees stability in the direction of public affairs and safeguards public offices from the speculative turmoil of ambitious politicians. Furthermore, the venerable tradition which this institution possesses arouses a feeling which gives weight to the monarchical authority. Beyond this, there is the fact that the whole corps of officials, and the army in particular, are raised above the level of political party obligations. And still another positive feature was that the supreme rulership of the state was embodied in the monarch as an individual person, who could serve as the symbol of responsibility, which a monarch has to bear more seriously than any anonymous parliamentary majority. Indeed, the proverbial honesty and integrity of the German administration must be attributed chiefly to this fact. Finally, the monarchy fulfilled a high cultural function among the German people, which made amends for many of its defects. The German residential cities have remained, even to our time, centres of that artistic spirit which now threatens to disappear and is becoming more and more materialistic. The German princes gave a great deal of excellent and practical encouragement to art and science, especially during the 19th century. Our present age certainly has nothing of equal worth. During that process of disintegration, which was slowly extending throughout the social order, the most positive force of resistance was that offered by the army. This was the strongest source of education which the German people possessed. For that reason, all the hatred of our enemies was directed against the paladin of our national self-preservation and our liberty. The strongest testimony in favour of this unique institution is the fact that it was derided, hated and fought against, but also feared by worthless elements all round. The fact that the international profiteers who gathered at Versailles, further to exploit and plunder the nations, directed their enmity specially against the old German army, proved once again that it deserved to be regarded as the institution which protected the liberties of our people against the forces of the International Stock Exchange. If the army had not been there to sound the alarm and stand on guard, the purposes of the Versailles representatives would have been carried out much sooner. There is only one word to express what the German people owe to this army. Everything. It was the army that still inculcated a sense of responsibility among the people when this quality had become very rare, and when the habit of shirking every kind of responsibility was steadily spreading. This habit had grown up under the evil influences of Parliament, which was itself the very model of irresponsibility. The army trained the people to personal courage at a time when the virtue of timidity threatened to become an epidemic, and when the spirit of sacrificing one's personal interests for the good of the community was considered as something that amounted almost to weak-mindedness. At a time when only those were estimated as intelligent who knew how to safeguard and promote their own egotistic interests, the army was the school through which individual Germans were taught not to seek the salvation of their nation in the false ideology of international fraternization between Negroes, Germans, Chinese, French and English, etc., but in the strength and unity of their own national being. The army developed the individual's powers of resolute decision, and this at a time when a spirit of indecision and scepticism governed human conduct. At a time when the wiseacres were everywhere setting the fashion, it needed courage to uphold the principles that any command is better than none. This one principle represents a robust and sound style of thought, of which not a trace would have been left in the other branches of life, if the army had not furnished a constant rejuvenation of this fundamental force. A sufficient proof of this may be found in the appalling lack of decision which our present government authorities display. They cannot shake off their mental and moral lethargy and decide on some definite line of action, except when they are forced to sign some new dictate for the exploitation of the German people. In that case, they decline all responsibility, while at the same time they sign everything which the other side places before them, and they sign with all the readiness of an official stenographer. Their conduct is here explicable on the ground that in this case they are not under the necessity of coming to a decision, for the decision is dictated to them. The army imbued its members with a spirit of idealism and developed their readiness to sacrifice themselves for their country and its honour, while greed and materialism dominated in all other branches of life. The army united a people who were split up into classes, and in this respect had only one defect, which was the 1 year military service, a privilege granted to those who had passed through the high schools. It was a defect because the principle of absolute equality was thereby violated, and those who had a better education were thus placed outside the cadres to which the rest of their comrades belonged. The reverse would have been better. Since our upper classes were really ignorant of what was going on in the body corporate of the nation, and were becoming more and more estranged from the life of the people, the army would have accomplished a very beneficial mission if it had refused to discriminate in favour of the so-called intellectuals, especially within its own ranks. It was a mistake that this was not done. But in this world of ours, can we find any institution that has not at least one defect? And in the army, the good features were so absolutely predominant that the few defects it had were far below the average that generally arises from human weakness. But the greatest credit which the army of the old empire deserves is that, at a time when the person of the individual counted for nothing, and the majority was everything, it placed individual personal values above majority values. By insisting on its faith in personality, the army opposed that typically Jewish and democratic apotheosis of the power of numbers. The army trained what at that time was most surely needed, namely, real men. in a period when men were falling prey to effeminacy and laxity, 350,000 vigorously trained young men went from the ranks of the army each year to mingle with their fellow men. In the course of their 2 years' training, they had lost the softness of their young days and had developed bodies as tough as steel. The young man who had been taught obedience for 2 years was now fitted to command. The trained soldier could be recognized already by his walk. This was the great school of the German nation, and it was not without reason that it drew upon its head all the bitter hatred of those who wanted the empire to be weak and defenseless, because they were jealous of its greatness, and were themselves possessed by a spirit of rapacity and greed. The rest of the world recognized a fact which many Germans did not wish to see, either because they were blind to facts, or because, out of malice, they did not wish to see it. This fact was that the German army was the most powerful weapon for the defense and freedom of the German nation, and the best guarantee for the livelihood of its citizens. There was a third institution of positive worth, which has to be placed beside that of the monarchy and the army, and this was the civil service. German administration was better organized and better carried out than the administration of other countries. There may have been objections to the bureaucratic routine of the officials, but from this point of view the state of affairs was similar, if not worse, in other countries. But the other states did not have the wonderful solidarity which this organization possessed in Germany, nor were their civil servants of that same high level of scrupulous honesty. It is certainly better to be a trifle over-bureaucratic and honest and loyal than to be over-sophisticated and modern, the latter often implying an inferior type of character, and also ignorance and inefficiency. For if it be insinuated today that the German administration of the pre-war period may have been excellent, so far as bureaucratic technique goes, but that from the practical business point of view it was incompetent, I can only give the following reply. What other country in the world possessed a better organized and administered business enterprise than the German state railways, for instance? It was left to the revolution to destroy this standard organization until a time came when it was taken out of the hands of the nation and socialized, in the sense which the founders of the Republic had given to that word, namely, making it subservient to the international stock exchange capitalists who were the wire-pullers of the German Revolution. The most outstanding trait in the civil service and the whole body of the civil administration was its independence of the vicissitudes of government, the political mentality of which could exercise no influence on the attitude of the German state officials. Since the revolution, this situation has been completely changed. Efficiency and capability have been replaced by the test of party adherence, and independence of character and initiative are no longer appreciated as positive qualities in a public official. They rather tell against him. The wonderful might and power of the old empire was based on the monarchical form of government, the army, and the civil service. On these three foundations rested that great strength which is now entirely lacking, namely, the authority of the state. For the authority of the state cannot be based on the babbling that goes on in Parliament, or in the provincial diets, and not upon laws made to protect the state, or upon sentences passed by the law courts to frighten those who have had the hardihood to deny the authority of the state, but only on the general confidence which the management and administration of the community establishes among the people. This confidence is, in its turn, nothing less than the result of an unshakable inner conviction that the government and administration of a country is inspired by disinterested and honest goodwill, and on the feeling that the spirit of the law is in complete harmony with the moral convictions of the people. In the long run, systems of government are not maintained by terrorism, but on the belief of the people in the merits and sincerity of those who administer and promote the public interests. Though it be true that in the period preceding the war, certain grave evils tended to infect and corrode the inner strength of the nation, it must be remembered that the other states suffered even more than Germany from these drawbacks. And yet those other states did not fail and break down when the time of crisis came. If we remember further that those defects in pre-war Germany were outweighed by great positive qualities, we shall have to look elsewhere for the effective cause of the collapse. And elsewhere it lay. The ultimate and most profound reason of the German downfall is to be found in the fact that the racial problem was ignored, and that its importance in the historic development of nations was not grasped. For the events that take place in the life of nations are not due to chance, but are the natural results of the effort to conserve and multiply the species and the race, even though men may not be able consciously to picture to their minds the profound motives of their conduct.